There are eight bills in the victim prevention package being drafted in the Senate by Assembly Representative Joe Sanfilippo, a Republican from New Berlin, and in the Senate by Senator Leah Vukmir, a Republican from the 5th Senate District. So I welcome a chance to talk to Representative Sanfilippo about the bills in the package. Thanks very much, Representative, for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Appreciate it.
Is the focus of this package crimes by teenagers, or crimes by teenagers largely and then adults? Give us the overview.
The focus of this package is squarely on the victims involved in the crimes.
Okay.
So whether it's a juvenile or an adult, we are looking at habitual violent offenders. And what we're saying is for the last 10 years, our criminal justice system has focused on the offender, on the rehabilitation, the alternatives, and has completely forgotten about the victims. With this package of bills, we are bringing back what we feel should be as equal, if not the most important part of the whole criminal justice system, which is public safety. We need to prevent people from becoming victims to these habitual violent offenders.
What are the biggest problems reported by your constituents in the 15th in terms of they feel they're victims of what type of crime, sir?
I think it's a general uneasiness that you want to be able to walk out your front door, whether it's day or night, and feel that you're safe in your own community. And right now, our constituents, Senator Vukmir and I, can't really say that. I mean, we have crime that is in Milwaukee, but it's spreading into West Dallas. You know, a couple weeks ago, we just had a carjacking in New Berlin. And so those are the types of things that we are hearing on a regular basis and more frequently. The last couple of summers, I have ridden around on National Night Out with the West Dallas Police Department and McGruff the Crime Dog, and we go visit National Night Out block parties. Every year, more and more people are just telling me of, you know, crime that's happening in their neighborhood, but also just their general fear that, you know, gee, I don't feel safe for myself, for my kids, for my parents. We have a lot of senior citizens, you know, who are used to, you know, working out in the yard with their doors unlocked all the time, and they just don't have that sense of security right now.
Is the criminal justice system too lenient in your mind on adults or juveniles, Representative?
So I think the criminal justice system needs to realize that they have to work for the people it was intended to protect and give them as much focus as the people who are offending and going into the system. And I really do think that in the last 10 years or so, they have kind of drifted away from the victims and put all their focus on the offenders. And, you know, and that's an important task, right? If somebody makes a mistake the first time around, you want to work with them, you give them a chance to go through a rehabilitation program, and, you know, they go back into society to become productive law-abiding citizens, and you never hear from them again, that's perfect. So our package of bills is focusing on the habitual offenders that, you know, maybe have already cycled through the system one, two, or three times, but yet are still there being that trouble for the police, going in front of the judge. And so those are the types of people that we're saying we need to focus on.
Before we talk about these specific bills, let me ask you this. How well is DOC done if their focus has been on rehabbing those that have been convicted and sent off to our institutions?
So I've had a lot of concern with Department of Community Corrections within DOC. Almost from day one of me coming into the assembly, I had a constituent issue that was brought to my concern, so I started working and looking at the DOC. Well, as I spent more time digging into that, it kind of expanded into, okay, you know, now we're going to start looking at the district attorneys and judges and police and kind of looking at the entire criminal justice system as a whole. So over the last two summers, I have met with district attorneys, assistant district attorneys, judges, police officers, community corrections people, just trying to see where is that breakdown that is leading to this increase in violent crime. Because if you take a look at the DOJ tells us that, you know, over the last few years, we've actually gone down. We've had, you know, 60-some thousand less arrests last year than we did the prior year. But that doesn't mean that our crime is getting better, because then the same department tells us, but violent crime is increasing. So we're trying to look at what is the cause and effect that is leading to this, you know, this issue where we have crime on the rise. And, you know, it's a very serious issue. And again, I just feel so thankful to be able to work with somebody like Senator Vukmir and Senator Wongard with his background to be able to start focusing on this issue. These eight bills that we're working on introducing right now, it's not the end of the discussion, it's just the beginning.
Okay. Well, thanks to your staff, you sent me summaries of the 8 LRB bills. Why don't you talk about, start with the 2 or 3, 4 most important changes, and then we can cover some of the others. So talk about some of these specific bills.
So I think that probably one of the most important issues we're looking at is preventing victims from falling prey to these habitual offenders, right? And so it would start with community corrections. They have had the tendency to not want to put people in offenders who don't follow the terms of their supervision, to run them through a revocation process and whatnot, and continue to have them on the street. Mm-hmm. So the result of that has been I have police officers and judges telling me, hey, we're arresting the same people, they're coming in front of me, they're out on supervision, so they're not only violating the terms of that supervision, but they're out committing more crimes. Why are they even on the street to be able to commit a crime? Because they're not following the terms of their supervision. So we take away some of that discretion with the department and say, you know, put a mandatory trigger in that if somebody is out on supervision mm-hmm. and they commit a crime, the department doesn't have the discretion. They have to put the
It's automatic to go back to prison.
That's correct.
Do you laundry list the crimes? If they recommit, you automatically must go back to prison? Or is there some discretion there?
What we're looking at primarily is violent crimes.
Violent crimes.
Right. So, but again, when you're on probation, you know, you're already on your second chance. Right, so we need to hold you to a higher standard maybe than, you know, everybody else, because you've already been given that little extra advantage to stay out of jail or out of prison, but you also have to live up to your end of the bargain. And I think it's important for us to realize there are some people that are going to be able and willing to go through a rehab program and an alternative program, and they're going to come out just fine. But again, where we're drawing the line is habitual repeat offenders.
I'm going to show my ignorance here. Are there juveniles now that are out on probation, parole, or extended supervision, or is it just adults? I'm sorry, I don't know the answer.
So juveniles, they don't necessarily call it probation or parole, right? But through the detention process that they go through, the vast majority of them are not put into a detention program,
okay.
Right? They're put into some type of a rehab program. Most of them, unless they're determined by a judge to be a serious danger to society, mm-hmm. that's when they would go into a detention program.
Is this designation that your bill drafts deals with serious juvenile offender? Talk about the designation and the changes you would make in the judge's authority on that designation.
Sure. So the serious juvenile offender statutes are already on the books. There's two changes.
Only apply to juveniles, correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
There's two changes that we're making to them right now. Right now, the statutes say that no matter what the crime, no matter how dangerous a juvenile may be,
or
after 3 years of being in a detention,
yes.
the system has to release that person.
Must.
You
no discretion.
No discretion. It doesn't matter. That person could be, you know, even while in detention, the most violent person that they have seen, they have to release them. So what we're taking away that 3-year maximum, and we're allowing the judge and the system to use discretion to say, you know, some people, maybe that's fine, maybe they need less than 3, but there are certain people that just does not make sense for us to turn them back out into the community, because they're only going to reoffend and be right back here again.
Do you then lift that 3-year cap, make it 4, 5, or 6, or is it open-ended?
It's open.
Open-ended.
With the maximum, though, the statutes right now say no juvenile can be incarcerated past age 25, so that would ultimately be the max, as nobody's going to go beyond 25, and we don't change that.
As a result of this, wouldn't judges keep or assign more of our juveniles to our juvenile prisons, wouldn't they?
Not necessarily, because the criteria is set in statute of who is eligible as a juvenile, who's eligible to go to a detention center. They have to be serious offenders. They have to be, in the judge's mind, a danger to society in order for them to go in. So we have tens of thousands of juveniles that go through the juvenile justice system mm-hmm. every year. A very, very small fraction of them are actually put into detention programs.
Okay. You deal with the expungement of records. I don't understand that bill, so can you explain it to me?
This is a bill that came to Senator Vukmir and I directly from a constituent of ours. And the way the expungement law is right now is if a juvenile is charged with a felony or serious misdemeanor, it's on their record. But at the time of sentencing, they have to ask the judge for expungement, even before they've gone through their sentencing, and the judge has to grant it or not grant it. Well, you don't know if somebody's going to successfully go through their rehabilitation where, you know, you allow them to be expunged. So that's one of the problems. So by moving the expungement request to post-sentencing and post-adjudication, what we're saying is we give somebody the opportunity to carry out their sentence, and you know, whatever that is, that doesn't always mean detention. Maybe it just means you're on probation or supervision, and these are the terms of it, right? So you have to successfully go through the terms of your adjudication, and then you can ask for expungement, and you can also ask for it at the end of the period as opposed to the beginning. In this particular case of our constituent, her son was never informed right up front that if you don't ask for an expungement now, you can never ask for it.
Oh, okay.
So as a result, he has this issue on his record, which could have been expunged had they have just asked before during sentencing, but they didn't know that. So this is going to prevent that.
You don't change the laws what crimes, what convictions have to be posted on CCAP, do you?
No.
You do not?
No, we don't touch CCAP.
Okay. You increased the mandatory penalty for murder, secondary homicide. This was what you alluded to earlier as one of your top priorities in this, right?
Again.
And this is for adults and juveniles?
Yes.
I'm just trying.
And,
okay.
And violent offenders. So we've increased the list of felonies that a juvenile could be sent to detention for to match more along the lines of if an adult would have committed the same crime, would they have received a felony and been incarcerated. Nothing in the bill says the judge has to do that. There's no mandatory minimums or any mandatories whatsoever. It's just an additional tool that a judge will have when he's determining what is the best course of action for this individual.
What support are you getting for your eight bill package? Is the governor going to endorse any of it in the budget message on Wednesday?
I have not spoken with the governor specifically about any of these eight bills. We've had discussions in the past about the crime issue. I can tell you from not only these eight bills, but other bills that I have proposed in the past, crime right now is on everybody's mind in every square inch of the state. It may be different issues. Milwaukee area, it's violent crime. In other parts of the state, it's drug addiction and things like that. But it is on everyone's mind, and every district attorney, every judge, every police officer that I have spoken with is honing in on trying to get a handle on exactly what is going on that's leading to lower arrests, but yet an increase in violent crimes.
If all these eight bills became law a year from now, several years out, wouldn't it dramatically increase the budget of the Department of Corrections, which you know is a $1 billion, sometimes it exceeds the UW, but you know what intrigues me? In the new information paper from the Fiscal Bureau, the cost per year of keeping a juvenile at Lincoln Hills or Copper Lakes, $106,000. Won't your package require taxpayers to pay for more juveniles in these juvenile prisons?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, it's important to point out that the cost to families victimized by violent crime far outweighs the cost to taxpayers to keep our communities safe. Also, our bills don't focus on incarceration and adding more people into the jail, but what our bills are focused on is preventing victims. And that, I think, is where the priority needs to lie.
But won't it raise the costs of both county jails and our state prisons?
Well, I don't necessarily buy into that, because just because we are not sending an individual to jail right now or to prison doesn't mean that there is no cost to society. When you're arresting the same person over and over again, they're cycling through our criminal justice system, the district attorneys are working on sentencing, on charging, the judges are working on having these cases, there is a cost to society. So to say that we're going to save money by not locking somebody up is a complete fallacy. The cost is still there. It's just our local communities are bearing it out in police and district attorneys and the local criminal justice system as opposed to running prisons.
Do the police chiefs, the sheriffs, do their associations support your package?
Everyone that I have spoken with so far, to some degree or another, is in support of these eight bills.
And then what about the district attorneys, that wing, that arm of the criminal justice system that would prosecute these?
Yes, I have met with a couple different district attorneys, you know, including the district attorney in Milwaukee County, which is one of the areas of concern that we have here. And, you know, everybody's kind of on the same page as far as is that they all recognize what their responsibility is, but have different ideas on how to get there. And as I mentioned prior, the criminal justice system has primarily spent the last 10 years focusing on the offender. How do we rehabilitate somebody? How do we get them through an alternative program? To the extent that, rather than just giving somebody that attention on the very first crime that they commit, it's gone almost to the opposite way, where it's every offender, no matter how many offenses they have, goes through that type of a program. What we're saying with these bills is we need to consider the victims as much as we're considering the offenders in our criminal justice system. Don't feel that's happening.
Let's circle back to one specific crime that you mentioned earlier. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports there were 464 carjackings in Milwaukee. So what would your bill do to someone convicted of carjacking?
So first of all, it takes carjacking and treats it like the violent crime that it is. Right now, there's little distinction if a juvenile goes and steals your car out of your garage when it's just parked. Mm-hmm. He gets treated the same as if he puts a gun to your head or a knife to your throat and physically yanks you out of your car and as you're on the street and drive away with it. That was our two completely different crimes. So our bill treats the violent portion of that crime for what it is. But I think this exposes a broader problem in our criminal, in our juvenile justice system, right? We have a juvenile code that was written 40-some years ago when the things that kids were getting into back then, much different than what kids are getting into nowadays. So while a couple of our bills focus on some immediate issues we feel need to be attended to with the juvenile code, I believe that we need to sit down with a broad coalition of people involved and completely rewrite the juvenile code so it's modernized and fits what's going on in society today.
Well, one of those that helped rewrite that 40 years ago was Representative Fred Kessler. And he said, we got it wrong, and we should charge more of these in juvenile court and not adult court. If you seek to rewrite the juvenile code, what's your view on that issue? When should you be charged as an adult?
So again, I think that keeping in mind the focus of the criminal justice system is public safety and preventing people from becoming victims, you have to be willing to draw the line and more clearly say who is a good candidate, willing and able to go through a rehab program, an alternative program, and they're going to assimilate back into society and we're never going to have problems with them again, as opposed to who has been through the system 3 or 4 or 5 times and yet they're still out on the streets terrorizing innocent victims.
So your answer seems to be that the decision whether to charge someone who's 17 in adult court would depend on his or her past criminal record, correct?
I think, again, our entire package, bearing in mind we're focused on victims, but has to center in around habitual criminality. Everybody's going to make a mistake. We were all kids once. We've all done dumb things, right?
Yes.
But we have to draw the distinction between who makes a mistake and learns from it and who makes a mistake and continues to repeat that mistake. And we can't treat both of them the same because we're not doing justice to the victims of those crimes.
Have you seen a physical note on your package yet?
I have not.
Oh, okay. The issue of our juvenile prisons is the safety and potential mismanagement as being investigated by the FBI, by the federal DOJ. Does that issue travel separately from your package?
Yes. You know, what happened up at Lincoln Hills are reprehensible, the stories we've heard so far, and when the investigation is complete, we will deal with what comes of that at time and make changes at that point in time. But this package of bills that we hear is focused on the victims and not the offenders, and they really are two separate issues.
You and I, you've drafted this as an 8-bill package. You and I have watched the legislature for a while. If you only get 1, 2, or 3 of these, which are your most important bills?
That's a tough question because I think all of the bills, considering when you look at the crime rates in the state of Wisconsin, how they've been going up, assaults, sexual assaults, carjackings, homicides. Really, every one of these bills are important. If we don't get them all, will we consider it a failure? No, because I think at least we're moving the needle in the right direction. But each and every one of these bills is going to have a meaningful effect in preventing people from becoming victims and going through some of the horrendous things that are happening right now out there to our constituents.
Okay, but the first bill that you brought up is a one that would increase mandatory penalties for some of these violent crimes. So maybe that's the one, if you only got one, you'd most like to see enacted, signed into law?
Steve, I can't pick one. You're like asking me to pick which of my children are the favorite. You know, I think all of these are important.
Last week I interviewed Senator Johnson on her package that would cut down, she hopes, on gun violence in Milwaukee. Does your package pick up any of her changes? Is there some potential linkage here?
So I haven't had time to look at everything that Senator Johnson is working on. We have worked together on one particular bill that I think is important. But, you know, again, we're focused on the victims of the crime. We're focused on habitual offenders, and that's where we tend to be going with this package.
Okay, and how soon does it move? Do you hope to get hearings and committee votes on some of these before the budget, or are you talking fall?
Well, as you know, the budget's coming out next week, and then that's going to garner the lion's share of everybody's time and attention right now. So at this point, it's hard for me to say when we'll see any hearings or votes on these bills, but hopefully it'll be sooner rather than later.
Is there one anecdote about a crime victim you want to relate in terms of why you're sponsoring this package? You mentioned one, but any other one anecdote?
So some of my
personal
critics,
story?
Some of my critics had said, besides the expungement personal story, right, and the fact that we've had a carjacking in New Berlin now just within the last 2 weeks, some of the critics have said, you know, you're from the suburbs. What happens in Milwaukee should be dealt with, you know, by the legislators from Milwaukee, and it affects the people who live in Milwaukee. There's a story yesterday in the Waukesha Freeman about a woman who was murdered in Milwaukee, but she lives in Oconomowoc, and all she was doing was going to work. So the crime issues, just because a person may not live in the city of Milwaukee or in any particular area, crime has a wide-ranging effect on everybody, and it is a statewide issue.
Milwaukee Democrats then should vote for your package?
Yes, because what they need to do is realize that the victims in their communities deserve just as much respect and attention as the offenders.
Okay, thank you. Can we go to a different subject?
Yes, we can.
You've been critical of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. The audit just came out saying that in many of these project estimates, they've been underestimated by a factor of one half. I'm interested in your response to the audit. Was that news to you? You've been working on the issue for a while.
So it wasn't not necessarily news to me that it was happening. To the extent of some of those jobs, as far off as they were, you know, was kind of eye-raising. But, I mean, let's face it. Under our prior secretary, we had a horribly and disgracefully run department. It is very out of control over there. There's no accountability. And I am hoping that I'm cautiously optimistic that the new secretary is going to be up to the job to really take a look at what's going on here and straighten it out. Because this is not only one of the biggest expenditures we have in an agency, but one of the most important.
Your caucus leaders have asked for a March 15 letter saying, what is the realistic, what are the new costs of some of these major projects that lie ahead in the next 2, 3, or 4 years. My question is, on the highway funding issue, where are you now post-audit? Do you see any need to raise any revenues for transportation in the next budget, Joe?
Well, the audit hasn't really been able to give me a clear path of do we need more revenue or we don't need more revenue. What the audit has done is confirmed my suspicions that we have a horribly mismanaged department, and our first and primary focus needs to be in bringing that department into more efficient standards, and then we can get an accurate idea of if we need a revenue increase, and if so, how much, and what is the best way of doing that. I personally am not comfortable continuing to put all of our revenue eggs in the gasoline tax basket, right? Because everybody tells us that our driving is going to be much less, right? The millennial generation opts for public transportation. They're not as much into car ownership as we have been. Cars are getting much better mileage, and that's by government regulation. So in the next 5 years, I think the fuel efficiency standards are going up even higher. We have electric cars and other alternatives coming to the road. So I think even if you raise just the gas tax, that's still a diminishing rate of return. You're really not fixing the problem. So we need to take a look at it as a whole and see, you know, is there a better option out there?
You said you've met with the new Secretary of Transportation, Mr. Ross. What did you advise him as somebody who's been studying these cost overruns and how the Department of Transportation has been doing these highway projects?
So I told Secretary Ross that he needs to strap on his boots, get out of the office in Madison, go out to every district in this state, every DOT district, walk the jobs, and not just visit the job trailer. Get out there, walk the jobs, talk to the contractors that are building them, talk to the engineers that are designing them, talk to the local municipalities where these projects are being built, and listen to them. The department has been very arrogant in dictating from the top down, from Madison, what's happening up in, whether you're in Eagle River or you're in your New Berlin or wherever, without listening to the actual people in those particular jobs in those particular areas. And I think that if he does that, he is going to get a very good and a very eye-opening look of what is going on with the hierarchy here in Madison.
And until you get more information, you're with Governor Walker that there should not be any increase in the 30.9 cent gas tax or the $75 vehicle registration fee?
Yes, because I cannot look my constituents in the eye right now and tell them we need X amount of money to fix this problem. Until I can do that, I can't support a tax that I know is not really going to fix the problem.
Okay, now let's return to the victim prevention package. Are there going to be some public hearings? Have you and the senator formally dropped these bills into the process, and do you expect hearings soon?
We're out for co-sponsorship right now. We do expect to have some hearings. These are very important issues. We look forward to working with our colleagues from all around the state who can talk specifically about issues that are happening in their areas. And in the end, what we want to bring to the floor are eight bills that all of us, Democrat and Republican, from no matter what part of the state you're in, can agree that protecting victims is very, very important, and we can all support these bills.
And someone watching this show who them or a relative, someone they loved, has been a victim of a crime, what should they do next to work on your bills?
They need to contact our office or Senator Vukmir's office or Senator Wongard's office and tell us their stories, and more importantly, be willing to come when we have those public hearings and testify, because there will be no problem getting opponents to come and speak about why we should continue to focus on offenders. But we want to bring the victims into the discussion, and we want the criminal justice system to focus on the victims, and we need to hear from the victims to tell their stories.
Thank you. Representative Joe Sanfilippo of New Berlin represents the 15th District. He is the Assembly Chief Sponsor of the Victim Prevention Package. The Chief Sponsor in the Senate is Senator Leah Vukmir. Joe, thanks very much for talking to Wisconsin Eye.
I appreciate being here. Thank you.
Thank you.